welcome to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. It is Friday, January 25th, 2013. Today's program, Building a People's News Media in the 21st Century. We'll talk about corporate media hegemony, top-down managed news propaganda, and grassroots resistance with Professor Robert Hackett of Simon Fraser University and Tracy Rosenberg of Media Alliance for most of the show today. Near the end of the hour, we'll check in with Sansara Taylor, who is on the streets in Washington, D.C., participating in events marking the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and talk to her about media framing and propaganda of the patriarchy 40 years on. Welcome back to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, Building a People's News Media in the 21st Century. We're going to be talking about corporate media hegemony, top-down managed news propaganda, and the grassroots resistance building this people's media. So it's definitely a Project Censored Friday here with the theme focused on media, media freedom, and media democracy. Near the end of the program today, we will check in with Sansara Taylor. She's participating in events marking the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, so we'll be talking with Sansara about media framing propaganda of the patriarchy 40 years on. But here's Peter to introduce our guests for the first part of the program today. Peter?
Well, in studio with us is Robert Hackett. He's a professor and researcher at the School of Communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. His main area of research has been media activism, political communication, and news analysis. Since 1993, he's been co-director of NewsWatch Canada, a news media monitoring project, which actually started out very similarly to Project Censored. And he's also on the board of directors of several journals, including Journalism Studies, a peer-reviewed academic journal. He's been involved with several community media action education initiatives and is very involved in Vancouver's annual Media Democracy Day. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
It's great to have you here. Also in studio with us is Tracy Rosenberg, who has been the executive director of Media Alliance since 2007. She has organized and advocated for free, accountable, and accessible media systems worldwide, focusing on the protection and sustainability of alternative media outlets, monitoring the mainstream media for accuracy and fair representation, and facilitated the training of numerous nonprofit organizations and citizens throughout the Bay Area. She currently sits on the board of Alliance for Media Community Media Western Region, the Pacifica Foundation, and she's very active in the Media Action Grassroots Network. So, Tracy, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Bob, let's start out with you. Tell us about NewsWatch Canada. And you have a list of news stories that are similar to like what Project Censored does, only you focus on Canada. Tell us a little bit about that and how you do that.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. It's NewsWatch Canada started in 1993, and I've just realized this is our 20th anniversary this year. We started actually as Project Censored Canada, inspired directly by your project and with advice from your founder, Carl Jensen, at that time. And is actually at the initiative of the Canadian Association of Journalists, a member of their board, wanted a way to see how the Canadian media were doing at a time of cutbacks and growing corporate concentration. And he came across a bookstore, in the bookstore, your yearbook. I think it was perhaps one of your very first yearbooks in 1993, and thought, we need something like this in Canada. And he approached several universities, and we were the ones who took the bait at Simon Fraser University in our School of Communication. And we've been doing various versions of an annual seminar, student seminar, to do research on blind spots in Canada's press ever since then. So in the mid-1990s, we did a top 10 list of underreported stories, much as you do here. And then we switched to doing studies of specific coverage of specific issues since then. But a year ago, in 2011, we returned to doing a top 25 list, actually, just to see if indeed Canada's press had the same kinds of problems that you've been identifying each year for decades now in the United States. And we found, perhaps a little to our disappointment, that indeed we do. We can't claim to be all that much hugely superior, although we often like to think of ourselves as having, you know, a more open political and media system in Canada compared to the U.S. But we came up with stories like The implications of the Canada-Europe Economic and Trade Agreement, which is being negotiated behind closed doors.
Free trade, yeah, exactly.
Basically, free trade between Canada
hidden from
and
the
Europe.
Public. All right.
The record of Canadian mining companies and the lack of accountability. I think Canadian mining companies around the world are giving our country a terrible reputation in terms of the environment and human rights. One of them, our number eight story, this is for 2011, was the long-term effects of the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. And I think that's a global story, right? But we're particularly affected by it in Western Canada, if indeed there are stronger radiation impacts than has been publicly reported by governments. So we had a somewhat similar list that indicates that our own corporate press isn't really doing the watchdog job they really should be doing.
Bob Hackett, that list sounds eerily familiar to us here at Project Censored. Fukushima, number three on our list this year. We've certainly had many stories on so-called free trade agreements taking place behind closed doors. I also notice you have the ongoing underreporting of very serious issues on asbestos and so on, and public health issues. So certainly we have a lot more in common in as far as that goes than we may like.
Well, that's right. And some of these stories are specifically Canadian, about the treatment of Aboriginal women, about the health effects of Canada's tar sands. I don't know how much you hear about that down here, but it's a mega project with global implications for climate change, for example.
Yeah, a former student of mine, Jody Martinson, actually did a documentary on the tar sands up in Alberta, up mm-hmm. in Calgary, and had seemingly a fairly wide audience about that. Right. But that's coming to attention here a bit more. Mm-hmm. The XL pipeline, anyway, it did make some headlines this past year, but it's again disappeared. Mm-hmm. And while these deals go on, again, people need to know more about this in order to mobilize.
Yeah. Well, we just heard this week that 53 senators have signed on, and so they now have a majority in the Senate to approve the XL pipeline to bring it down from Canada, of course, all the way to New Orleans. So that's going to be a whole lot of oil flowing across the country through aquifers and environmental areas, yeah.
Tracy Rosenberg, let's bring you into the conversation. Media Alliance actually was founded in the same year as Project Censored, 1976, although it's changed a great deal over the years, mm-hmm. and you've been there as executive director since 2007.
Yes, I have, and from 1999 from 1997 until about 2002 as sort of an assistant director.
Well, tell us about Media Alliance. You know, let's remind people what's going on at Media Alliance. You've been at the front lines of some of the battles for free press, consolidation issues, and so on. So tell us more.
Yes, indeedy. Well, I think what's always challenging when you're talking about media activism and media advocacy is sort of what to work on, because there are so many things wrong. Media Watch Canada does and with what the Media Freedom Foundation does each year is just sort of detail the many ways in which that's playing out. We try to get to the causes of what's causing all of these inaccuracies and failures to report and news not getting out that people need, and what can we do from the grassroots place to try to mitigate some of that. And there's about a million answers to the question. But a couple of things that we're kind of trying to focus on right now is some of the media ownership struggles that are continuing in Washington, D.C., that are about whether all of our print and broadcast outlets are basically all going to turn into exactly the same thing. Right now, they're not, they're mostly the same thing, but at least it's the same thing operated by different corporations. You know, one kind of mega corporate press.
Six or so.
Yeah, but the question is, do you go down from six to two? So we have that going on. In addition, we're sort of looking at corporate control of the internet and the telephone system and the technology and where that's going to go in the future. Are we going to have free technology, or are we basically going to have not free technology? And the last thing is really community, media, and alternative voices, and how we can keep some spaces somewhere for the word to get out.
tiered access.
Well, yeah, well, Tracy, and I'll throw this question to Bob too, but Tracy, let's start out. We have this terminology, the media democracy movement, which has been around for a decade now or better. And that includes grassroots media mobilization and a challenging to, corporate media consolidation. Yes. Which we have not been very successful with that. I mean, Ben Bagdikian, of course, when he was writing back in the early 80s, there were 50 major media corporations. Now we're down to under 10.
Yeah.
If we count the primary news ones, it's really about six. So, and this is global.
Yeah.
This is worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we see a very, very similar framed news relative to, you know, pro-capitalism, transnational corporations, globally. You know, and war, and Bob has done some serious research on that. So what do you think media democracy means today, and how do you envision us making these kinds of broad-based changes? We'll start with that, then we'll move to Bob.
Wow. Well, whenever we talk about anti-corporate activity, as you said, it's not really just a question of Americans doing battle with American corporations. We're in a global scenario. Corporations exceed boundaries. They run past countries, through countries, and on top of countries, and the media system is no different than any other corporate system. So we are talking about sort of a global battle. And part of what we have to look at is the ways in which media democracy movements also start to exceed countries and exceed those kinds of national boundaries. Because if that's what the other side is doing, that's what you have to be doing. And I think we have a lot of work to do in that regard.
Robert Hackett, you're a professor and researcher at School of Communications at Simon Fraser University. You've traveled the world, literally, researching media democracy movements. You host the Media Democracy Days in Canada and are very involved with that. How do you see this? What's happening worldwide? Give us some examples of some of the places you've been and what people are doing at the grassroots.
Yeah, that's obviously a pretty big question, but fortunately, there is a lot going on to talk about. I can only offer a few highlights in a couple of minutes, but in Britain, for example, there's been the Leveson inquiry into the scandal involving Rupert Murdoch's newspapers over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
In which they were hacking into private people's phones and interfering with police investigations, abusing the power of that mammoth media organization to corrupt the course of justice and also to influence politics through inappropriate relationships or even, you know, bribery of police, for example. So that led even the government to sit up and take notice. They were forced to. And it led to something called the Leveson Inquiry, which just reported a couple of months ago. It also stimulated media activism in the UK in the last year or two, so that groups like the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom and the newly formed Media Reform Coalition, who've been saying these, pointing to the dangers of media concentration for decades, feel finally vindicated, and they now have a window of opening in the policy process to say that we need to do something not only about media behavior, but about the very structure of media and in terms of diversifying ownership at the very least. So that's one area. There's been a great deal of activism. In a quite different context, I've been to Fiji, where the struggle is rather different, but nevertheless, it's similar in the sense of how do people develop a media system that helps to achieve just and sustainable democratic governance. Fiji is still under a military dictatorship. They've had four coups in the last 20 years, and they have significant ethnic tensions between the two main ethnic groups there, indigenous Fijians and Indo-Fijians. And I think the problem there is a little different from simply fighting corporate control or the commercialization of media. They need independence from government, but at the same time, they need media responsibility. An American-style commercial press system is not likely to work there. It's likely to actually inflame ethnic tensions that have led to coups and bloody riots in the recent past. So they need something different there, but they need a media democracy movement as well, and that is emerging around the idea of communication rights. So, and in Canada, there's a great deal going on that we can talk about if we have time. But I think the most significant group that I'm aware of, beside, to toot our own drum, the Media Democracy Day annual celebration of alternative media and media literacy and media policy change that you've talked about, is a group called Open Media. fighting for an accessible and affordable internet. And they've had a good deal of success in the last 5 or 6 years that they've been in existence.
Bob Hackett, you mentioned a moment ago, you were talking about the changes in media in places like Fiji. You mentioned that the American commercial model wouldn't work there so well. It's arguably not working well here either, except for the owners of the media, in terms of free press principles. Let's turn this around for a minute and look at maybe this open media idea. What might we learn from how free press systems are trying to develop in other places of the world?
The issues are seemingly diverse, but really it's a common struggle, I think, against both authoritarian government and corporate control, which is, in a sense, a kind of private government, right? So I think if you turn specifically to open media, they've been brilliant in innovative modes of organization. I'm proud to say, started by a former student of mine, Steve Anderson.
This is Open Media in Canada.
Openmedia.ca. You can easily find it online. And they've now got over 500,000 supporters online, a contact list of over 500,000, which translated into the U.S. context would be the equivalent of 5 million Americans, right? The population difference. So they're one of the most successful advocacy groups in Canada at the moment. And they've actually had some policy wins, or at least being able to stop the regulators and the government from, you know, doing worse things than they would have otherwise. They've had a successful campaign around stop the spying, save the internet from surveillance. The government withdrew from legislation that would have enabled them to monitor email and people's, internet independent service providers and force them to hand over information without warrants. The government backed away from that after Open Media organized a huge online petition. And they use other methods as well. They combine it with entertaining forums and ways. They've managed to engage thousands and thousands of young people, mainly internet users, who have never previously participated in policy processes or paid much attention to political issues. And I think that's a dramatic breakthrough.
Tracy Rosenberg?
Yeah, well, to get back a bit to some of the things that we can learn from other parts of the world and some of the connections between international media activism and what's going on here, I think when you look at other parts of the world, you see a couple of trends, and one of them is the use of radio and community-based radio, largely because of costs. Radio is the most accessible form of media out there. And you also see a lot of mobile technology and people using phones in order to sort of communicate quickly, mobilize and activate themselves and get out, shall we say, real-time reporting. And the interesting thing is that as time goes by, partially perhaps because of the economic dislocations that we're going through, many of these things are also starting to happen here in the grassroots people's media movements, of which, of course, this station that we're sitting in is one of the forefathers or foremothers of that. But as time goes by and as that kind of activism happens here in the 2000s and in the 21st century, you have a movement for low-power FM radio, which is very much about people's collectives in a low-budget way, making radio to serve people in their neighborhoods. And then you also have all kinds of, shall we say, hacktivism, which is also very much about using the internet to break through and to make real connections. So I think it's interesting that sort of, I don't want to say low budget, but the kinds of techniques that people are using in Honduras and in Africa and in Siberia are also starting to be used by media activists here, because we're all fighting the same thing and some of the same techniques work.
Tracy, in Venezuela, the Bolivarian movements in the south now have been very active in creating community radio stations.
Yep.
Venezuela has over 1,000 community low-power radio stations that the people are running themselves. Cuba has the same.
Mm-hmm.
And do you envision this happening in the U.S. as an alternative, literally, to corporate media, that we wouldn't even really need them? In some sense. I mean, let's put it like that.
Well, if the Low Power Radio Act, which we finally passed in 2010 for the whole country, not just part of it, is something that we are able to sort of fully develop, then we may start to be able to look at that kind of a functional alternative media that may make it easier for people to really kind of turn their back on the major broadcast outlets. The question becomes whether if enough people really aren't tuned in anymore to CBS and CNN and the Chronicle and so on, will they actually lose their power to impact events? And I think that we are starting to see the beginnings of that trend. And the question is, can we keep it going?
Bob Hackett, what do you want to add to that? And also, you know, there is a media reform movement in the U.S. They're having their conference in Denver this coming April. But a lot of that movement has focused its, if you look at it in a top-down way, a lot of its energies, if you will, toward attenuating the dials of officialdom in the major media institutions through the FCC and so on. And they haven't been very successful, right? You go back from 2008 to now, when a lot of the attention was on fixing the FCC, so-called, and then the candidate of Hope and Change trademark comes in, and more of the same. So first, maybe comment a little bit on some of the possibilities that you see, but also maybe do you have any critiques on the reform movement here?
Well, I'm not as familiar with the media reform movement in the States as in Canada, but I think you need both. I really do think you need people who engage with the policy process and to, you know, intervene to at least stop its worst excesses, and that are prepared to build coalitions and alliances, even with groups on specific campaigns that you wouldn't normally otherwise work with. I believe in one of their campaigns, Free Press even worked with the National Rifle Association, right, around issues of media ownership diversity. So I do think there is a space for that, but you also do need the grassroots energies. You need the media justice movement, which is analytically and politically distinct from media reform, okay, that builds from the grassroots up and comes directly out of the energies of social movements for racial justice, for example. And in Canada, we have had successes, even at the policy level. I think that Open Media participated in a campaign called Reimagine the CBC, which is to try and reinvigorate public broadcasting, but also to develop a constituency for public service broadcasting amongst younger people. And the new chair of our regulator, the CRTC, which is the equivalent of the SEC, complimented Open Media and its partners for actually changing the nature of public participation in the whole regulatory process. And that's a significant achievement as well.
Tracy Rosenberg, have you seen that here?
Oh, sure. And I live right in the place where the media reform and the media justice movements merge and fight and criticize mm-hmm. each other. And I put myself in the media justice camp. But that said, I spend a lot of time harassing the FCC. So, you know, I think a couple of things. First is that regulatory, some kind of intervention and regulatory oversight by the government is a tool that we can use to keep the corporations from moving as quickly as they want to move. When we're talking about corporate control of the internet, we do need government intervention to slow down what they're trying to do. So I feel, as a media justice person, while I don't think that the government controlling AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon is the full extent of what we need, it's sure something that I need them to do and that I'm going to ask them to do. And to be fair to the National Conference on Media Reform, there'll be lots of media justice folks there and lots of grassroots media activists there. And I think we've come a long way in terms of saying both are important, and that these are not opposed methodologies. They're hopefully complementary methodologies. But yes, I certainly think the sort of red, white, and blue media reform classic model has been shown by an awful lot of people to be not nearly as much as we need. There has to be more. That's only one step.
Right. It sounds like these multi-front approaches, diverse approaches, all around, is what we're looking for to achieve a more media democracy.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a brief musical break, and when we come back, we'll be continuing our conversation with Professor Robert Hackett and also Tracy Rosenberg, and maybe we'll try to move a little beyond media reform and talk about media revolutions and peace journalism. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show in the Morning Mix. This is Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We're joined today by Professor Robert Hackett of Simon Fraser University and also Tracy Rosenberg of Media Alliance. So we're having a morning of talking about media and media changes, media reform. Also, before the break here, we had hinted that we want to talk a little bit more about maybe what are some revolutionary necessary trends in media, and that may focus on peace journalism, environmental journalism, and a journalism that helps respond to a world in crisis and help the population understand what can be done about that. Bob Hackett, did you want to...
Well, yeah, I think the question is, once you get free media, suppose we, let's assume we're going to win the battle for democratic media. What do you then do with them? What kind of journalism do we need for a world that frankly is in crisis from climate change, global warming and other environmental problems, but also growing conflict that is associated with those problems, growing discrepancy between rich and poor in the world and so on. So I've been working on looking at two paradigms, two different ways of doing journalism that I think are actually well related to each other. Because after all, if the proverbial visitor from Mars dropped down and looked at our press, the dominant media today, and, you know, tried to figure out what was going on our planet, they'd have very little sense that we're actually a planet in crisis. So I think two alternative approaches are those of peace journalism and environmental communication. Peace journalism is a different way of reporting conflict. And the best way of describing it is it's what happens when journalists make choices of what stories to report and how to report them that create opportunities for society to consider and value nonviolent responses to conflict. And that's a quote from its one of the two leading trainers and advocates in this area globally, Jay Clinch and Annabelle McGoldrick. Environmental communication is somewhat similar in that it calls upon media to help society respond to environmental signals appropriately, to make decision-making processes about environmental issues more transparent and publicly accountable, to help engage groups with the natural world, and to identify harmful policies and indeed propaganda. And that's a model that's being developed by Robert Cox, a professor of communication amongst many others. So if you combine those two things, I think you could argue that journalism ought to redefine itself as a crisis discipline, that we should be crisis-oriented. And, you know, that's a core task of journalism, surely, in a democratic society, is to alert society to the problems it's facing and help us to deal with them. So I think that, to me, is the next step of what you actually do with free and democratic media.
Having a peace journalism would be very different than the corporate journalism we see today, which will be literally a press release that 18 insurgents or terrorists were killed by a drone yesterday in Yemen or somewhere else in the world. And it's just assumed that, oh, this is okay, this is the ongoing war on terror, and it doesn't have a conversation about why this is happening, what the U.S. empire, NATO empire is doing worldwide. Tracy, does your training, your training journalists from kind of the bottom up too, and do you incorporate these kinds of themes into these training packages?
Well, what Bob is talking about is sort of a set of critiques of what you would call classical journalism training, and basically the platitudes regarding objectivity that have been taught to generations of journalists, and sort of saying in a world in crisis, and I think this is very much like the platitude on the wall, you can't be neutral on a moving train, the question becomes sort of what is the responsibility of the journalists regarding the information that people need to know and the crises that we're facing. Is it basically just to... is it basically to provide context? Is it basically to go into this work with a sense of what we are trying to help people to understand and the kinds of decisions that we're trying for them to make? Or is it simply to basically report dates, times, and the number of casualties and move on? And, you know, this is partially a values conversation, and it's also partially a public interest conversation. You know, what is the public's interest in journalism? What does the public need and want from the practice of journalism? And when you're talking about sustaining models of journalism, what's worth money to the public to pay for? because frankly, you can read the AP wires on the computer now. You don't need someone to read it to you on television or on the radio. So the question becomes, if we are in fact looking for people to sustain journalism and not corporations, what is it that they will pay for and what can you offer them that's different than what they can get on the computer?
And Tracy, what would that be?
I think it has to do with background and with context and with putting together a set of facts and a set of perspectives to curate information basically so that it helps people to make sense of what's in front of them and to interpret what's happening. In other words, why was there one more drone attack in Yemen and 18 people died? What does this mean? Why did this happen? What does this have to do with what happened 20 years ago? And what will happen in the next 2 weeks?
Context providers, and certainly part of what Project Censored's been doing over the years is looking historically at underreported stories, untold histories, uncovering these things to provide the context in the present that makes telling these current stories meaningful.
And how do we do responsible analysis and interpretation, not sensationalistic analysis and interpretation, but responsible, that respects the intelligence of the audience and, you know, maintains a relationship to accuracy, but also to comprehension.
Bob Hackett?
Yeah, that attention to context is one of the core principles of peace journalism as an alternative way of reporting conflict. I can identify a couple of others, and one is to pay attention to the multiplicity. There are multiple stakeholders in a given conflict or issue, and yet the dominant media tend to reduce it just to a question of one side versus another side, and usually the leaders of two sides, you know, Democratic versus Republican spokespeople, and then think that they've done their job simply by reporting what political elites on either side, as it were, of two issue of two sides say.
And that type of framing is a propaganda all its own, and it oft masquerades as some type of objectivity.
Well, exactly. It appears to be a balanced and neutral report, and yet it really has the impact of reducing the range of public discourse. And that's a very important sort of professional criterion in journalism that needs to be challenged. As does the high degree of dependence on official sources. Peace journalism also calls upon us to pay attention to peacemakers and the victims of conflict and war, for example. To diversify and broaden the range of sources is another very important way that journalism needs to be changed. And another one, another principle of peace journalism is to consider not only today's battles and shootings and today's events, but to consider the patterns of structural and cultural violence that underlie conflicts. Structural violence being institutionalized violence like racism or unemployment and poverty. And cultural violence being the kind of worship of violence and the military that, as a Canadian, seems to me very widespread. Every time I come to the United States, it seems to be an aspect of the culture here that needs to be challenged.
We use the terminology managed news, propaganda machine, in the context of truth emergency, certainly in the context of corporate media today. Your book, Expanding Peace Journalism, you helped edit that book in 2011. Is that having an influence, or not just a book influence, but is there an influence within schools of journalism to take this approach in a broader way?
I think that peace journalism as an approach is expanding. But I have to say, frankly, that at the moment, it seems to be finding the most fertile soil in countries of the global south at the moment, places like the Philippines and Indonesia, and indeed Fiji, the South Pacific, and parts of Africa, and Colombia, for that matter, which have experienced extremely serious internal conflict. And for understandable reasons, the media were seen as playing a role in those conflicts. One thinks most dramatically of Bosnia and Serbia, or Rwanda in Africa, where the media almost actively helps to incite genocide and ethnic cleansing. I think it's in countries like that where peace journalism has the greatest traction at the moment, but I really think of all places in the world, we most need it here in Northern America. Because it's we who, you know, help finance some of the worst violence, institutionalized and military violence in the world. So we really need this kind of more contextualized journalism. before we simply, you know, acquiesce in yet another war.
Tracy Rosenberg, we have about a minute left in this segment. Do you want to finish up for us, have some last words, and also give people information where they can find out more about Media Alliance online?
Sure. I think there's lots of traction for the ideas that Bob is putting out in the States to be encouraging. It's just that a lot of that traction is within the citizen journalism movements and the grassroots movements. And right now, just in terms of reach and in terms of resources, those are in a somewhat secondary position. But that may change as the years go by. You can find out more about MA and our work on our website at www.media-alliance.org. And thanks for having me today.
Bob Hackett, a website or someplace people can find out more about the really wonderful work that you're doing at Simon Fraser.
Thank you. Openmedia.ca is one. MediaDemocracyDays.org would be another. That's the annual celebration. And then the website for Newswatch Canada is a bit more complicated, but you can easily Google it. Just don't get fooled by the corporate project with the same name. Ours is based at Simon Fraser University.
Oh, yes. And the conference that we mentioned is the National Conference on Media Reform, which will be at the Denver Sheraton, April 5 to 7, with all of our criticisms. It's a great conference, and you can find out more at freepress.net/conference.
And Project Censored will be there with you. After a short musical break, we will return, focusing our attention on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, with Sansara Taylor, Professor Robert Hackett, Tracy Rosenberg. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're welcome.
Stay with us.
A great day for shopping. I can feel money dropping. People, that's what I'm copping. So for sale.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show in the Morning Mix. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We turn our attention now to activities going on in Washington, D.C. We are talking with, on the phone, live at some activities, Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, a host of WBAI's Equal Time for Free Thought, and sits on the advisory board of World Can't Wait. She has written on the rise of theocracy, wars, and repression in the U.S., led in-building resistance to these crimes, and contributed to the movement for revolution to put an end to all of this. Sansara Taylor, you join us live from Washington, D.C.
I do. Thanks for having me, Mickey. It's good to hear you.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you back on the program. We're really glad we could get you. We know you've been really busy this week, fighting as you do against many forms of oppression, including the patriarchy. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Yes, we're in Washington, D.C. first, just to set the moment. We're on the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, which, as you said, is the, you know, legalization of abortion in this country. And yet, at no point in the last 40 years has abortion been more stigmatized, more dangerous to provide, or more difficult to access. And so I'm with the StopPatriarchy.org movement, and we're here in Washington, D.C., and actually in San Francisco, too, for a week of action to defend abortion rights and stand up against the war on women. And today in D.C., there is what's called the March for Life. We like to call it the March for Forced Motherhood. It's tens of thousands of religious fundamentalists, forces, Christian fundamentalists, and Catholics who are marching against all forms of abortion in all circumstance, against all forms of birth control. And they need to be opposed. And so we are here with our signs, with a new movement that says abortion on demand without apology, forced motherhood is female enslavement, and this direction has to be fought. We've been out all week around the city on the college campuses and in different ways defending the clinics here. And here we are really to confront and expose this march for what it is. They don't care anything about women. They don't care anything about so-called babies. They really care about forcing women to have children against their will and returning to the biblical standard for law and for women in society in this country. And this has gone on unopposed for far too long, and so this is why we're here.
So, Sansara, hi, this is Peter Phillips. Good to have you on.
Hi, Peter.
We've had across the country, and particularly at state levels, state legislatures are restricting women's access, cutting down funding for anything having to do with abortions and or birth control. We're seeing a systematized nationwide attack on women's rights. How does the corporate media report this, or do they?
Well, I think it's been very paltry reporting. I mean, I think even your listeners, probably many of them feel, and I think a lot of people feel, that they've heard the story on this. They've heard the comments from Todd Akin about rape, legitimate rape, and if it's a legitimate rape, a woman can't get pregnant. They've heard the comments from Murdoch about pregnancy from rape is a gift from God, and they think, oh, we are hearing this story. But what's not being reported in the mainstream media, and what's also not being understood by people broadly, is that this attack is not only coming from the Republicans. The leading edge of this attack on abortion is coming from the Republicans. And yes, a lot of the restrictions in the last 2 years, record numbers of restrictions have been passed at the state level, mainly by Republican-controlled Congresses. But at every step along the way, this attack has been conciliated to by the Democratic Party. And so a lot of people are under the impression that now that Obama won the election, now that the elections are over, abortion rights are safe, and this could not be further from the truth. One thing that's noteworthy is that even, for instance, Murdoch, who said that pregnancy from rape is a gift from God, he was defeated in the election. But he was replaced by a quote-unquote pro-life, in other words, anti-abortion Democrat. This was not a victory for women. This was a further revelation that the whole framework is to the right, and women's rights are being used and pimped by the Democratic Party, but they're not being protected by the Democratic Party. And this, again, underscores why StopPatriarchy.org is out in the streets building a movement and millions of people to fight for this and say what no politician will say, which is that abortion is perfectly moral. Abortion is not murder. Fetuses are not babies. Women are not incubators. You'll never hear that in the media. You'll hear a lot of conciliation, even from the quote-unquote advocates for abortion rights. And I think this is something that has left, you know, we've witnessed it on the ground here. It's left generations of people, at least two or three young generations, who have never heard anybody speak about abortion in a positive way. Yesterday, when we were out at Howard University, we met students, including one young woman. We were talking about the right to abortion, how essential it is, how perfectly okay it is, and how it has to be defended and destigmatized. And this young woman looks at me after talking for a few minutes, and she says, you know, I have to ask you a question. I say, okay, go ahead. She says, I think I'm pregnant, and I'm really scared. I don't know anybody to talk to. This is the situation we've stranded millions of young women and millions of rural women in. It is so stigmatized. It's so difficult to access. 97% of counties in this country that are rural do not have an abortion provider. People don't know how dire this situation is for the majority of women across this country. And I don't think this is being properly reported. It's not known about. And then people are not being told that there's another way to fight besides relying on the Democrats, besides relying on what is frankly a bankrupt and dead-end quote-unquote pro-choice movement at this point, the NARALs and the Planned Parenthoods, who are basically subordinate to the Democratic Party, that there's another way to fight this that is actually required.
Censara Taylor with Revolution Newspaper, also World Can't Wait, StopPatriarchy.org. Censara Taylor, a couple of years ago, one of the top 25 censored stories was South Dakota taking extreme measures to be the top anti-abortion state. We've looked at this at Project Censored for some time. 87% of U.S. counties have no abortion providers. 92 new laws restricting abortion were passed in 2011 alone. And as you alluded, there's very little coverage of this in the corporate media. There's a lot of framing going on, and certainly the experience, the anecdotal experience you just described, ought to be somewhat startling to people given the history of Roe v. Wade. What's the alternative, Censara Taylor? You had mentioned that groups like NARAL and Planned Parenthood, I mean, sort of been defanged, so to speak, or are maybe not able to do as much as they'd like. I'm sure there are different interpretations of that. But Censara Taylor, what are you calling for, and what alternatives do you see? And what did you tell this young woman?
Well, I want to start by being very concrete. When I talk about Planned Parenthood and NARAL being dead ends at this point, Planned Parenthood, on the 40th anniversary, took the occasion to drop the label pro-choice. They said this is too divisive. This is a personal issue. Pro-choice was already a major retreat of the bourgeois women's movement away from saying the word abortion because it's becoming increasingly stigmatized, so they backed away from that. We're not, no one's for abortion, we're for choice. Well, actually, I'm for the right to abortion. It's a positive thing. Being able to terminate a pregnancy when a woman doesn't want to have a child is a very positive and very liberating thing, and it's not murder, it's not wrong, and we have to talk about that. That's what people haven't heard. So I want to be specific about the need to stop this politics of conciliation to the anti-abortion movement and stop the reliance on voting as the limit of what we can envision. And this is why there does need to be a movement on the streets that's confronting the anti-abortion movement, that is exposing them for what they are. That's why we're here at the March for Life in D.C. today at the Supreme Court. That's why tomorrow in San Francisco, people should join with StopPatriarchy.org out there and go to Justin Herman Plaza at 10 a.m. and rally for abortion rights. And then at noon, join them at the UN Plaza as they confront the Walk for Life out in San Francisco. And then to come, and we're going to be out there in the streets as a vehicle to build resistance to this and to change the terms, to say what no one has heard. Publicly change the terms and mobilize many others to stand up and fight. After this, we're doing International Women's Day protests around the country. But I think what I told this young woman, I said, well, she asked if I would go with her to get the abortion, and I told her I absolutely would if I was in the city, but I don't live in D.C. But I told her that I would speak to her about finding someone who could go with her and help her talk to her friends about it. And mainly what we did is we talked through on the street why I listened to her explain her reasons why she wanted to get an abortion, and I reaffirmed to her, because I don't think she had anybody in her life who would do that, that those are legitimate reasons. She wants to finish college. She doesn't have a partner to raise a child with. She's too young for it. She wants to play soccer. I told her those are all good reasons not to have a child. There's only one good reason to have a child, and that's because you want to. Being pregnant is not a good reason to have a child. So we kind of talked that through. On one level, I think that was a great measure of relief to her, but I am going to be calling her and following through with her. Unfortunately, there's actually, like I said, millions of women like this around the country who need access, who need help, who need support. And actually, one in three women have had an abortion. If the more that our message gets out, the more we publicly manifest resistance and plant a different pole, the more the people who already have had abortions, have gone through this, will feel that they can share those stories with the women in their lives and the women around them.
We're almost out of time here. We're talking to Sansara Taylor. You are physically in Washington, D.C., counter-protesting the big life movement march that's happening there. Do you feel endangered at all, or is there, you're a minority, apparently, in terms of what's happening on the street today? What's really happening there?
Well, I think, it is true. The anti-abortion movement is motivated at its core by a belief that God has cursed women for causing original sin, that we have to have babies to redeem ourselves. That's sort of at the core of their movement. And anytime you have a fundamentalist movement of any kind, Christian fundamentalist, Islamic fundamentalist, you are going to have people who believe they're on a mission from God and carry out violence with God behind them. So there are very dangerous people in this crowd. The other day there was fanatics when we were at the Supreme Court on the actual anniversary of Roe versus Wade who were very threatening. A lot of the people who come through, though, and I think this will be true as well at the Walk for Life in San Francisco, are high school kids and college kids from Catholic schools who are bussed in. A lot of people who are just learning about this issue and who've never heard a counter to the anti-abortion rhetoric they've heard their whole lives. And so we've actually gotten into, we've been very careful with those who are more threatening, and we are sticking together and watching out for each other. But we're also very much, we want to engage these young people who are here.
Sansara Taylor, I'm afraid we're out of time. Sorry to cut you off. We're out of time for this morning. We look forward to having you back on the program sometime soon and can follow up on some of these issues.
Okay, thanks so much for having me, and I really appreciate it. So It's good to talk to you guys.
Sansara Taylor, StopPatriarchy.org. That's all the time we have for the Morning Mix Project Censored Show today. We have a couple quick announcements. Of course, we have these demonstrations going on in the San Francisco Bay Area, 10 a.m. Justin Herman Plaza, Saturday, tomorrow, 12 p.m. UN Plaza, San Francisco, rally to oppose the Walk for Life, 1 p.m. Powell and Market protest and confront the Walk for Life. If you're interested in that, go to StopPatriarchy.org. Also, spaghetti dinner for the 99%, dinner and program honoring foreclosure fighters featuring Will Durst. That's Thursday, January 31st at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Center, 1187 Franklin Street, corner of Geary Boulevard in San Francisco. There's a 6 p.m. dinner. There are speakers. And at 8 p.m., the film Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? General admission, $20. Students, seniors, $10. Wheelchair accessible. And one more, Vixedo in concert. Go to vixedo.com. Celebrate Tom Paine's birthday, Tuesday, January 29, 7 to 10 p.m. That's at the Humanist Hall in Oakland, 390 27th Street. In Oakland, California. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Thanks so much to Tracy Rosenberg, Professor Bob Hackett, Sansara Taylor. Also, thanks to Rod Akeel and Anthony Fest at the controls. We look forward to seeing you next week.